Hello, and thank you for joining us for episode 106, the second installment of our new writer series on the Motorific podcast. In this episode, we continue our conversation about things a new writer should consider, including a few basics about gear and insurance, as well as a few writing tips and techniques.
I'd say gear is a pretty obvious decision. However, it's not obvious to everybody because clearly there are people who wear absolutely nothing, and you always look at them and wonder why until it's you. And I think that many people fall into this category of, yeah, look at him riding nothing. He's stupid, whatever, whatever. But then when it's you, well, now the rules have changed. It's like everything's okay when it's your kid, but when it's someone else, then, you know, all bets are off. So it's just, you know, gear's an obvious thing. Invest in real gear. Invest in a real full-face helmet. Invest in everything. And that money should be added to your bike budget. If you're going to spend $6,000 on a bike, well, you should add at least $1,000 for your gear. And yeah, I know grand's a lot, but we're talking gear that actually does things. Because, of course, you could walk into a Salvation Army and buy a bunch of random clothes that you want to define as, quote, gear. But let's be honest, it's clothing. And you're not shopping anymore at the mall. These are protective items. It's safety equipment. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why State Farm gives me $1,500 to replace my safety equipment. And that's my gear, head to toe. When I crashed, they said, send receipts. I did. And I got a check for like $1,200 because I used my jacket. I used my pants. I used my armor. I used my boots. That's why they're going to give you this money. And by the way, if your insurance company doesn't, then you need to shop around and find a better one that does, or pay more than just the $15,000 minimum and the $30,000 minimum for coverage.
It's under other.
Under other things. Although that, I want to quickly just address that too. You really, really, really want to talk to your insurance agent as to whether your limits are really going to cut it. Because, for example, if you have no health insurance and you can't afford it, because we all know health insurance is not cheap. If your motorcycle insurance covers absolutely nothing for you for medical payments and care, now what are you going to do? And if that cost is like another $10 a month or something to add $20,000 in medical expenses, liability, whatever, that should be worth it to you because you don't have health care. So you really want to also look at your motorcycle insurance options and see, what am I really getting? And should I be paying the $5 more or $10 more to get coverage for something I don't have money for? And I think everyone looks it over and they just buy the cheapest, the easiest, and the least protective insurance they can because they don't think they're going to need it.
And that's one of the benefits of also being face to face with an insurance broker. Is to say, hey, do you ride? Do you have a lot of motorcyclists come in here? I want to talk about the policy. You know, I want to feel comfortable. I personally am so overwhelmed when I buy insurance, and I have insurance for just about freaking everything. And I want to go and talk about it with someone who's going to explain what this stuff means for me when I actually need it.
Ooh, and that's a good future podcast. We got to do that.
If you don't get that feeling from the person or the group that you're talking to, there's probably, you know, if you really want Progressive and you know what you're doing, get it online. Sure, go ahead. But
insurance.com.
If you kind of want to talk to someone about it to fully understand what it is you're getting into, face-to-face for me has always been super helpful, at least as far as the home and the cars and such. But, you know, like Joanne said, I had other, which was $1,500 of coverage, and that'll sometimes cover aftermarket parts that you might have, your GPS unit, you installed it, but it didn't make it through your crash.
Luggage.
And you want to replace it, then that becomes a part of it. But for me, the $1,500 applied to gear. So,
the other thing that insurance covers are people who don't have any. Because if some idiot on his or her cell phone hits you and it's clearly their fault, but they aren't driving with insurance and you didn't get uninsured, you don't have it. Now you're screwed because you didn't buy the policy part to cover someone else, which sucks. But let's be honest, there are a ton of people out there who don't get their driver licenses. They drive on suspended. They don't pay for insurance. Sometimes they don't even register their vehicles and they just drive freely without any thought or regard to what could happen if they get in an accident. So insurance is not just for your vehicle, but it's for you because you don't know what other people are doing or not doing. So really take a deep dive into that. There's a lot of resources online. I just met a guy actually who's a broker and I met him a couple of weeks ago at the Women's Motorcycle Summit, and he gave a wonderful workshop on why you need more insurance than what you're paying for. And he really broke down what each category means and how that could really affect you negatively. And you're not spending like $20,000 in insurance. He's talking about spend $10 more every month and you're going to get, you know, up to six figures more coverage than what you have. We're talking minimal dollars to increase your coverage, not like, you know, thousands of dollars. So the costs aren't as high to bump up, you know, what you got. So other things to look at, you know, is certainly with gear. And like I said, sometimes your insurance will cover your gear and your parts. If you just threw down $5,000 for an Akrapovic full exhaust system, then you probably want to get that back. If something happens to it, you know,
usually it's the first thing to get scuffed up when you, when you drop it
or whatever. If you spent $2,000 on really great aluminum luggage, you probably want to get that back. Those are things you can ask your insurance about. And certainly with gear, I'm always going to recommend better than the minimum because you can buy a $50 helmet. You can buy a $10 pair of gloves. You can buy $50 riding jeans. And you can buy $40 sneakers. But is that really any better than what you got? How is that really going to help you? And I think that's a whole nother conversation to have as far as, you know, good gear, cheap gear, better gear. But sure. Consider
an episode in and of itself.
It is. And that's something I'm going to be covering in my other podcast. And I'll throw in a little plug for that at the end. But just think about real gear, not just what you have in your closet. But please consider real stuff from brands I recommend, brands that Christy uses, real brands that motorcyclists wear, not just fake gear. A couple other kind of random tips we got about gear. Tuck in your shoelaces or ditch the shoelaces. But if you have some, yeah, tuck them all in.
As Joanne would tell you, as long as you're not crashing in it, gear that's made well might be expensive, but you can also possess it for many years and not have to worry about having to immediately replace it. Helmets are excluded from that because after like, I don't know, 5 years or so, you usually want to get a new one. But, you know, a good jacket, good protective pants, as far as I know, and Joanne can correct me if I'm wrong, the CE rated hardware that's in there, all the armor is not going to disintegrate after a couple of years. So if you buy something that's a little bit more expensive than what you want, but you really like the way it looks, you're going to be motivated to put it on. It's protective and it's made well. It's going to last for a while. And so also something to consider when you're looking and your eyes are getting huge when you realize that this is an outlay of cash by wanting to ride. But we just want to let you know that, you know, the safer you can be both in practice and in learning and in skills and in gear, the longer you can enjoy motorcycling. And I think that's something that everybody kind of aspires to. So,
and like I said, I'm going to give you a nice resource. We'll give you some resources for this too, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in a different podcast. But so beyond your body, once you get on your bike, now you have to think about riding. And I do want to throw out one thing out there for some of you who might be considering learning to ride without knowing how to drive a car. Now, I would argue that a stick shift is not a requirement. I don't care what anyone tells you. Tell them to call me because I will argue the crap out of this with them. You do not need to know how to learn stick shift or how to drive stick shift. It can be helpful, but I knew how, but that didn't really affect my ability. But don't consider it something you need. It's just kind of a nice to have. So you do need to know how traffic works. You need to know how stop signs, what they mean. You need to know what the lane markings mean. You need to know how traffic flows. You need to know when cars are going one direction and not another, and what it means to merge and yield. And I think traffic patterns and having driven a vehicle in it is a must, because now you're really climbing Mount Everest, because on top of learning to ride a motorcycle, now you have to figure out what's the difference between merge and yield and stop. How do I know I'm not going to get my ass kicked because I didn't pay attention to the sign and I did not know what two solid yellow lines meant from a solid white and a hashed white? Or mm-hmm. I did not know what this red marking on this curb was or that. You got to learn to drive. You have to. If you actually want to succeed and not make this the most painful, awful, stressful, frustrating experience of your life, get some driving lessons if you need to. Give yourself some time, maybe 6 months, to drive a car before you attempt to drive a motorcycle. Because I believe in, I'm sure, I'm just guessing, that in most states, you got to have a car license in order to get your motorcycle license. Because they need to know that you know the difference between a red light, a yellow, a green, a flashing red, a flashing yellow, and how to handle a broken stoplight, how to handle, you know, different intersections. Because for motorcycles, intersections are one of the deadliest places for us. That's where crap happens, right? Mm-hmm. Intersections, solo motorcycle accidents because of DUI, other solo accidents.
Yeah, you know, I've never thought about that, but I don't think you can just get your M1 in California. Like in California, the M1 is a credential that is added to your Class C license.
You
so
used to.
You would need to.
That's what I'm saying. I think it depends on your state.
That's quite an outlier, though, of people who are riding but have no interest and or have never driven a car. That's probably a small percentage.
I would think so, but I think it's out there, and I think people... Mm-hmm. I've met a couple people and I was really surprised by that. But definitely get your car license or have some car experience before you jump out on two wheels.
And just sitting in the passenger seat, as we all well know, does not mean that you have driving experience, because
no.
The most ineffective memory that I can possess is by being a passenger or by being someone who follows. Because if you were to, I don't know, hey, Christy, follow me. I'm going to go to Joanne's. Okay, great. And then I follow, or I'm a passenger in a car and we get to Joanne's. I can't tell you how to get back to Joanne's ever again. I need to like physically be in the process of looking for things and looking at signals. When I follow people, it's like my memory turns off in my brain. So likewise, if you're sitting in a passenger seat, you're not actually driving the car or you're not actually riding the motorcycle. There are quite a few things that are substantially different from going from passenger to actual rider.
So a couple of actual riding techniques that you may want to consider, and I think these came through from queries we sent to people to answer, right? Like what kind of riding techniques should you practice? And let's see, the first one is practice lane positioning and understand where you are in the lane that makes you vulnerable by not being easily seen and allowing the space to maneuver in. I think.
Yeah. So in other words, if you're going around a mountain corner or a twisty road, mm-hmm. being in the center, being close to the double yellow, doesn't give you as much physical visibility as it would if you're at the furthest part to your right. Because you can, if you're imagining going and it's a left sweeper, the farther you are to the right, the more you can see what's coming. And that could be a car in the other lane or a car in front of you that stopped or potentially someone who's going all the way over into your lane. As far as like having enough space to maneuver in, I think the idea was, you know, if you're riding in traffic, And I usually pick like either the center, which I know some people say, center's a really bad spot because cars usually drip all their fluids in the center. You run that risk, but center and sometimes third of the lane is where I like to be. As far as maneuvering, always position the motorcycle, if you have a car in front of you, such that you have an escape route. Sometimes I like to be in the left lane, which actually means you have to ride a little faster, but the left lane or the slow lane in California freeways usually have a nice shoulder. And so if I suspect there might be anything wrong with the motorcycle, I'm going to be in the right lane so I can pop off to the shoulder really quickly. Likewise, the left shoulder near the fast lane is also a good spot in the event something gets a little hairy in front of you and you need to veer off. Just always have an exit strategy, awareness of the cars and what's going on around you.
Also practice your emergency maneuvers. If you have time, well, hopefully you can make some time, go to a parking lot and practice straight line braking. Practice swerving around, I don't know, an empty can. Practice stopping in a corner. Practice all the emergency maneuvers that you learned or you think you're going to need in traffic, because when it comes time to use them, you may not remember if you actually haven't used them, or if you didn't do them very well in the class, then the parking lot's a good opportunity to practice stopping again in 20, 30 feet. Practice swerving around things. Just because the swerving can be kind of challenging. But try to spend some time, you know, also practicing the things that you hopefully you don't need, but you want to know that you can really, you know, perform effectively before you actually need them.
And one of the reasons why I say learning on the dirt first to make yourself a little bit more acquainted with what it's like to lose the back wheel is always nice when you don't have ABS and you do have to do an emergency braking maneuver. Let's say the light suddenly turns red and you need to stop and you're going a little bit faster, thinking that you're going to go through the yellow, is having your locking your rear brake because you use too much of it, and having your rear wheel kind of like almost join parallel the front. If you were learning on dirt first, you probably wouldn't be nearly as panicked as I was when that first happened to me.
A really bad spot is to try to lane split against parked cars. You're trapping, which is, I believe, illegal. I believe that's not okay in California. You shouldn't be lane splitting in a place that makes you excessively vulnerable to where you don't have an out. Just think about
on the right,
your out.
Right lanes in general for lane splitting or a no. Right lanes
if
against parked cars, right lanes and the next lane over on a freeway. The right lane is going to be where most of the changing lanes activity is going to happen. And so if you want to avoid people going from right to left and left to right and not seeing you, you need to remove yourself from that particular area of lane splitting. Lane splitting is best served on, you know, the faster lanes all the way over to the left. The more you make yourself vulnerable to the right, the harder it is. People are just, all right, now I'm on the freeway. I've got to get all the way over to the left. And so that's pretty much, you know, you can predict. These are things that you do when you're, you know, driving a car. You get on the freeway, you get all the way over. So try to avoid lane splitting in an area that's going to have a lot of passing going on. Just more tips on lane splitting. You always want to kind of cover the rear brake. Lane splitting after it was officially voted in as being legal in California, I don't know that they've come across the how-to guide just yet. There was, for some time, a Highway Patrol safety guide, and then they pulled it because lane splitting wasn't still technically legal. I think there are some other ramifications, reasons why. But at that time, they had advocated going faster than 40 miles per hour was ill-advised, and going faster than, like, say, 15 or 20 miles per hour faster than the cars around you was ill-advised. And if you're in California, you see a lot of people while you're driving blaze past you. I have been scared as a driver behind the wheel and surprised by people who have scooted by me at breakneck speed. And the problem is that the slower they're going and the faster that you're going means that you're not, you will have extremely reduced ability and area. You know, you have very little option of going to the left or going to the right. If your lane is putting in between traffic, there are cars everywhere. And if someone opens their door or if someone drifts a little because they go to change the radio dial, you're going to have a very difficult time reacting appropriately if you're going too fast. And so another thing also is the plastic or the paint that you're riding on. That surface, not really greatly conducive to braking. So,
honestly, there's a thousand different things about riding that we can tell you. And there's no magic formula for if you do this, then you will be fine. There's just no such thing with riding. It's just important to get out there and ride. And I would say one of the worst mistakes that I see new riders make is they don't ride enough. They think once a week or once a month is going to cut it. And it's just not. You have to get out there and make yourself go riding a little bit every day, because it's something that you will not be comfortable with until you get yourself uncomfortable and go riding. So yeah, it can be
building muscle memory too.
Well, that's the whole point is you.
Yeah.
If you don't go out and actually practice every day for, I'd say, a month, you're going to start to lose everything you learned. And it's just going to slow you down, because now your dream bike is 5 years away instead of a year away because you didn't put any time in to get better. So there are a lot of other things like, you know, studying counter steering, looking at group riding, you know, improving your U-turns, that sort of thing. But I guess I can't really think of anything that I think, besides your emergency riding techniques and practicing your cornering techniques, to be vital or more important than the other. It's all important. But for me, emergency maneuvers to save your life and save someone else so you don't have to, quote, lay it down. Those are things I think that are really important to try to figure out. And I'll be honest, I did not spend a lot of time on those things back then, but I also had the fortunate opportunity to become an MSF rider coach. So I spent a lot of time actually practicing it on little bikes, on the ranges and in classes while teaching people how to do it. I just didn't spend a lot of my own time practicing them. And I think that definitely helped me become a better rider, because I spent such a long time teaching people. But if you can, spend as much time by yourself practicing the things that make you uncomfortable. Practice a corner. Practice a tight corner. Just go slow. Don't go into it barreling, you know, 40 miles above the speed limit. But try to practice, you know, the things that make you uncomfortable so that you can become more uncomfortable.
And if you have a friend, if you have the resources, a friend that is really patient and you feel comfortable around, other people feel comfortable riding around this person, and they're willing to help you out and kind of give you constructive criticism and watch you ride, then by all means, talk to that person. But this is kind of something that's really important, where if you have to learn it, if you have to do it alone, it is totally feasible to, you know, practice cornering, or even if you're in an area where you can set up a camera so that you can see yourself going around a corner and then show that to someone if there isn't someone around to help you. It's certainly better practicing these things by yourself than it would be practicing with someone who does not have the patience to teach.
And if you need that kind of help, then like we talked about earlier, search out some advanced training and search out classes. Shoot, if you have to, go back and take the course again. I know at the school that I used to work out, they used to offer a discounted rate if you only wanted to do a Sunday class. It was less than half price. It was like $100, and you could do the whole day, but only Sunday. That way you don't go through the basic stuff again, and you practice kind of the more advanced stuff. And I'm sure some schools would let you audit the whole thing, but if you need help, then go find it. But certainly, if other things have gotten in the way, like poor bike choice, let's face it, wrong bike choice, impossible bike to ride because you don't know how to ride it and you shouldn't have bought it in the first place, those kinds of things, it doesn't matter how much you practice, you may never be able to ride that bike. So definitely think through your decision making and make sure you've made close to the right choices. But on top of that, be ready to acknowledge, I screwed up. I shouldn't have done this. Now I'm going to fix it. Because certainly when you're out there learning to ride, if you don't prepare yourself to make a mistake and then get past it, you're just going to be hung up on it. You're going to be in your mind going over it 10 times why you dropped your bike. Just don't worry about it and at least figure out, I screwed up here. I shouldn't have done that. Now I'm going to practice it the right way and I'm going to be better about it, because then it'll make you a better rider versus being sad or crying or depressed or beating yourself up.
Or not wanting to ride because the more motorcyclists, the merrier. That's our intent. Our intent is for you to, for us to help develop your curiosity. And if it's right for you, then, you know, we want to help you. We want to educate you. We want to provide you with some options so you can make the best decision for yourself. So that's kind of our goal for this trio of episodes, if you will. And the next episode will cover bike purchasing. So, what bike should I get? And how do I go to a dealer and buy a motorcycle? How crazy is that? Or buying a used, which would be my default, off of Craigslist. We'll try to give you all the tips and tricks associated with that. And then hopefully the third in our series will be Joanne's plug of her new Gear Focused podcast. I will let you carry on from here.
Well, I started last week with one episode of basically the Gear Chick podcast, and it's on iTunes right now. It's also on my website under podcasts next to Motorific. And I'm just going to talk about gear. That's really the whole point. So it won't be riding related so much as clothing, gear, helmets, jackets, boots, pants, gloves, and really anything and everything I can think of as it relates to gear, including how to identify real gear versus fake gear, why you should stop stopping at the mall for your gear and you need to get out and go to a dealer or go online to like a Revzilla. I started my first episode by interviewing Tex Mobby. He's the national marketing director for TCX Boots. And then you're going to learn all about the company, what kind of offerings they have, but also you're going to hear about riding boots and what the benefits are and why you want riding boots and not boots from Zappo, which, by the way, they have a category there for, quote, motorcycle boots. But I'm going to tell you right now that 100,000%, those are not riding boots. Those are boots that look cool because they look like some boots you saw in a movie, or they look like what you see in magazines, but they are not real. So do not shop on Zappos for motorcycle boots. I'm sorry, Zappos. I love you. I've bought like 4 pairs of flats from you in the last month, and I will continue to buy my pumps and my wedges, but I cannot endorse your company to sell safety equipment to people who don't know any better. And to me, that is really not okay.
And Joanne is the resource for gear-specific type questions. So at some point down the line in our final, you know, new rider episode, we will kind of hopefully talk about gear and the kind of things that you should have from head to toe, because it's not just getting a good jacket and a helmet. It's way more than that. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tagging along. Even if you are an existing experienced rider, maybe we said something that hit a nerve. Maybe we provided some information that you could share with someone you know that's interested in riding a motorcycle.